Okay, good morning, everybody. Let's begin by getting comfortable in one's seat. Allow your shoulders to relax and your back to be straight. And as the body continues to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that you'll feel either at the abdomen or the upper chest. And while you are doing this, your body will naturally relax and the mind will become more focused. And with the body relaxed and the mind focused, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha and all the other Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas. There are also meditational deities. There are the Arahats and the protectors. And they're all in front of you in space. While surrounding you at the level of the ground or the floor are all sentient beings. Then recollect what you have in common with all the sentient beings who surround you. Then recollect that your wishes for long-lasting and stable happiness and freedom from suffering have not yet been met. But they could be. And they can be met if we rely upon those who have already accomplished that, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. So decide to take refuge in them to bring about your own welfare and the welfare of every other living being. So, Mufi, would you like to lead us through?
So, doing the refuge prayer, motivating especially for the health and long life of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and taking refuge on behalf of all the sentient beings that don't have the opportunity to be able to do so. And so, for the first few recitations, golden white light flows through you and all sentient beings, purifying all negativities. And then the continuing recitations, golden light flows into you and all sentient beings, bringing all realizations. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
And while you're in front of the refuge field, make a wish that all sentient beings accomplish the four immeasurable states and decide to establish them within those four immeasurable ways of being. And see yourself prostrating before the refuge field, making offerings, confessing and so forth, and recite along with me the seven limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the meritable, holy, and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, prepare to make the offering of the mandala. Think that by doing so, we free ourselves from all clinging, especially to the merit of our practice. Then recite along with me. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyatayami. The mandala has been released and accepted by the Buddha. And we look up into his face and he smiles at us with delight. And we feel accepted and at ease. The emanation leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends, entering the crown of your head, going down through your body, stopping at the level of the heart, and then filling your body and mind with light. And the light seeps out through the pores of your skin and begins to fill all of space. Wherever there are sentient beings, they are touched by this light and awakened fully. And there is no difference between ourselves and other. In fact, the ideas of self and other have completely vanished. And from the 10 directions of space, the light withdraws and re-enters your heart. Feel yourself embodied and you're breathing normally and naturally. And you are sitting in your seat. And you acknowledge that this has taken place purely on the level of imagination, and at the very same time has set a predisposition or a potential upon the mind to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then you breathe in deeply through your nostrils, and you exhale through your mouth, right, allow your eyes to flutter open, and be present in this room. Okay, so today we've got like 25 questions, and they're still based all around this section of the Lamrim Chenmo called Serenity and Insight. And the section we're really focused on is to do with serenity or calm abiding. And our tradition, the Gelupa tradition, present karma abiding as a stable, heightened meditative state in which the mind is focused tightly on an object of observation, and both the mind and object are clear and vibrant. And a meditator who has karma abiding can focus the mind on the object of observation without distraction at will for as long as he or she wishes and has complete control over the process. And having this complete control refers to the term known as pliancy. And when we have this pliancy, we now have karma abiding. And karma abiding is the goal of a type of meditation known as stabilizing meditation. And it's attained gradually over time through steady practice. It lays the foundation for insight into reality and all the different types of paths we can generate. And the questions we're going through are sort of all focused around this practice called karma abiding. And we're sort of the section that we're going in is really about some of the problems that we can face, like laziness, and then some of the different types of objects we could place the mind upon. And this time you can see I've had to rely upon quite a number of other different books to draw out more information to do with the questions. In particular, there's Alan Wallace's book out here on the far right called Shamatha Meditation, How to Practice It. And this was put together with one of his great teachers called Geshe Lam Rinpa. Then we have Balancing the Mind, again by B. Alan Wallace. And this was the first commentary in English on this section of the Lam Rinpa Chenmo, the section on karma abiding that came out. It's been reissued under a different title. And finally, I had to call upon this book called The Study and Practice of Meditation, Tibetan Interpretations of the Concentration and Formless Absorptions by a wonderful scholar called Leah Zala. So a lot of the answers that I've come up with come from these major texts. And there's another one, but I just, it's very, very good too. It's called Walking Through Walls. What's particularly good about that book is the number of different questions that the students ask the teacher and how these questions are answered, in particular to do with the section on pliancy, what pliancy is and how it works. So let's have a look, and we'll begin here. This question, so how do we prepare for the cultivation of karma abiding? So as you know, when we look at these questions, it's sort of like a brief review of what we've gone through in the past. So we should always begin with a mind seeking enlightenment for the benefit of others. So we start that. Then we have what's called the six preparations of the Jhoka practice. So can anybody know what some of these are? Can anybody recollect what they are?
Dwelling in an appropriate place.
No, this comes a bit later, Sue. This is very early here, this part here.
Is Jocho things like offerings, confession, guru devotion?
That's right. It's basically putting it around the seven limb practice.
Right. Because when we do Guru Puja, it's Guru Puja combined with Jocho, which are these extra.
Yeah. So it's just like how we started off today. You know, we set up the visualization, we do the four immeasurables, and then we do the seven limb practice. Then the mandala and so forth, and often a quick review of the stages of the path. And then we actually engage in the practices of the lower and middle scope. So So, as I said, and yeah, that's it. So we go through this, and then we would go and start off into the great scope and start off with equanimity and go up through the six causes of one effect, or equalized exchanging self and other. And then we would start with our calm abiding meditations. Now, our next question is, where did Lama Tsongkhapa teach about these six preparatory practices and so forth? So we have three of them. This is the one we're really relying on, the preconditions for meditative calm abiding. There are other two sections, how to cultivate calm abiding on that basis, and the measure of successful cultivation of calm abiding. And then we come to the next section, which you preempted, Sue, where the question was, what are these six preconditions for calm abiding? So again, this was the material we looked at last week. So we saw that we need to dwell in an appropriate area, to have a little desire, to be content, and these two and three sort of go together, to completely give up many activities. So meaning, basically, we're going to really focus here in on the development of calm abiding. Having pure ethical discipline. So this means that we know how to repair any breakages or leakages in how we're practicing in terms of our vows. And finally, it's easy to completely get rid of thoughts of desire. So I read over the last week, they said what it means here, well, in general, so basically, the greatest desire that humans have is basically around sex. So it's like they say, if you have a lot of sexual desire, this is going to get in the way of trying to develop calm abiding. Of course, what they're getting at, I think, is this idea that we have our greatest attachment to the pleasures of the desire realm, which is the realm we find ourselves in. Then we have...
Eddie, I'll just jump in here. I just remember the nuns saying that, you know, once they become celibate and nuns, then where all their desire's energy goes to is delicious food or really nice soap.
Yeah, so we find some other object.
Yeah, that's right. So there's still the desire energy, but you're kind of focusing it on less and less things. Yeah. And the last one to go is food.
That's right. Now, of these six, there's the next question that said, so of the six, which of them are the most important? So here we've got slightly different answers, and this is not uncommon. So Khyentse Rinpoche gave an answer, Geshe Sopa gave an answer, Lama Tsongkhapa gives an answer, and if you go to the other texts, you'll find the same sort of thing happening. So I took this from the Lam Rim, from Geshe Lama Tsongkhapa. The idea is trying to maintain pure ethics. So like I was saying, it's this idea of here, knowing how to repair vows. So it's quite likely we will damage them as we go through, but we can always repair them. And then to see the different types of desire that we have can be disadvantageous to the development of calm abiding. And finally, to find, you know, to dwell in that appropriate area. So when I look at this, I say, oh, there's you've got to take care of the physical side of it, and you've also got to take care of the mental side of it. Like I said, so this was all part of the review from last week, and the next one also has to do with that. So there was the question really is, what do we need to especially remove in the beginning? And I hope this picture shows us quite simply what it is. It's called spiritual sloth, which we normally call laziness. So here I'll just say a few things about this. And this is from Alan Wallace's book called Balancing the Mind. So Balancing the Mind was the book, the first commentary in English of this section, the Lam Rim Chen Mai. So Alan came out with a English commentary on the section on calm abiding. And it's quite very detailed, quite deep, and it was very useful for when we did the study on this section many years ago at the
Newmarket
Institute.
Oh, Chenrezig.
So here we go. This is, in terms of the immediate preparations for cultivating quiescence, which is another name for calm abiding, Tsongkhapa first addresses the obstacle of spiritual sloth. This is a mental process that is uniquely drawn to fleeting, pleasurable stimuli and is disinclined to virtue. It is regarded in Buddhism as a basis for mental afflictions and is incompatible with all virtues. He goes on to say, Indo-Tibetan Buddhist psychology lists four kinds of spiritual sloth. The first, the spiritual sloth of false mental engagement, which sees no need to practice Dharma. The second is self-deprecating spiritual sloth, a kind of depression that sees the possibility of practicing Dharma, but regards oneself as incapable of engaging in virtue. And the third, procrastinating spiritual sloth. It sees oneself as capable of practicing Dharma, but puts it off. And fourth, spiritual sloth that sees the need of practicing Dharma now, but is overcome by attachment to non-virtuous behavior. Thus, as this notion of spiritual sloth is so directly related to the practice of Dharma, it is misleading to render this term simply as laziness. But even a person who is very energetic and ambitious in a worldly sense may well be dominated by any of the four kinds of spiritual sloth. So that's why I sort of put this, sort of had to rely on quite a number of different books that probably many of you won't have. And this, many of these authors go quite in depth into this topic, and that depth is not obvious in the material that we've presently gone through.
Eddie, I find those four really interesting, how they're so detailed and what they are.
Yeah.
And of course, recognizing all four of them in myself. And I'm just wondering, like, there is a way to trick yourself out of that laziness of each of those ones. You know, like thinking, yeah, it's a good idea, but I can't do it, then just like lessening your perfectionism and thinking, well, just have a go anyway. You know, just little ways to get yourself into doing it without making a big deal, because it's like all of those things, there's a really big barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and of course, there are antidotes for each of these types of spiritual sloth, you know, everyone. Probably the major antidote for all of them is approached at the very beginning of the path in the lower scope, where it's looked at death and impermanence, because that's the sort of thing, and the fact that, you know, we have this human life, the leisure and opportunity to engage in practice. So it's sort of saying, look, you know, it's possible to do this. You've got a lot of good conditions already, and death is approaching every moment. So it gives you that sense of urgency.
Yeah, and just thinking, well, what if I couldn't do it? What if I was banned? Geshe Tashi Sering was saying that about, everyone's interested in tantric practice, but not everybody's interested in bodhicitta. But maybe if we said, only very special people are allowed to do that, and you mightn't be able to do it, and you mightn't be allowed to, then everyone would want to do it.
Yeah, quite likely. Is there any thoughts from anybody else? Yeah. Because now we're going to look at now the antidotes to these four types of laziness. So it's a nice term, isn't it? Spiritual sloth. It's got to, rolls off your tongue.
Oh, Francesca's got a question, by the way.
Yep. Fran?
Well, it's more of a comment, you know, because I procrastinate severely, but it's to do with the procrastination of perfection, you know, like if I can't do it properly, I don't do it. And it makes it very hard because it acts like a really big handbrake to everything I do, cool. You know, and, you know, there's a comment that I sort of read that Lama Yeshe said once where he just patted a student on the shoulder and said, you need to know how to say good enough, dear. And it's an interesting sort of thing because when a person, when I become so hard on myself for not doing it properly, not understanding that you've got to sort of fall over and stuff like that, it sort of stifles the whole thing. So, yeah, so it's an interesting one. So,
yeah, it's not uncommon either, Fran. And it's not just with spiritual practices, for many different things, like parenting in general. So there's a Western psychologist, W.S. Winnicott, and he came up with the term, like, good enough, to be a good enough parent. But you couldn't be a perfect parent, but you could be good enough. And it's the same sort of thing here, I think. But now we're going to look now at the antidotes, these four types of spiritual sloth. And I'm going to, they're a little bit different order here, and there's a purpose for that. So they are mental pliancy, perseverance, aspiration, and faith. Again, from Alan Wallace, but this is from a different book. This is a book on how to practice shamatha meditation. He says the four antidotes to laziness are interwoven into a tapestry of symbiotic dependency. Pliancy is indeed the primary antidote to laziness. But how does one cultivate pliancy? By means of continually cultivating enthusiasm for the practice of concentration. This has been enthusiastic perseverance. What is the cause of enthusiastic perseverance? A very strong aspiration to cultivate concentration. How does one cultivate a very strong aspiration? By faith that sees the excellent qualities of developing meditative quiescence. Faith, in turn, is cultivated by the first stirrings of pliancy, and the circle goes around again, with every turn increasing the strength of each of the antidotes. To draw a parallel, we can look at a mundane experience. We can see an object with excellent qualities and think we might like to acquire it. We ponder its excellence, reflecting upon it, upon how good it would be to have the object, of how many uses it would have. Through this process, our faith in the quality of the object increases until our aspiration to acquire it arises effortlessly. Aspiration continues to arise until the enthusiasm to buy it sends us scurrying off to the store. Once we have bought it, we come home and use it. In this analogy, the object is pliancy. So I was just thinking of like how I buy some of my clothes. You know, like I see it, I go, wow, I like that, I like the colors. Then what I do is I often go and see where it is, and I'll go down to the shop and I'll actually look at it, and I'll look at the price and I'll try it on, and then I hang it back up, and then I walk, then I go back home. Then I start thinking about it and where I'd like to wear it, how good it would look on me, and so forth. Then I go down and finally buy it, and then I bring it home and I'm happy. I can see better laughing and laughing.
But Eddie, doesn't that bring up a whole thing of attachment or desire? Right. So how do we moderate that?
Okay, so with my example, it's attachment, isn't it? To the clothing and what I look like and so forth. So here, attachment can also arise for karma biting. And in this particular book, Alan Wallace deals with that. He's got really good sections on what to do when attachment for this arises and what actually is attachment to karma biting. So this is true, friend. It's true that attachment can arise to karma biting as well as to clothing. But then, like I said, for both objects, there are antidotes. And yeah, the interesting thing is that if you use the idea, you go around and around, as he's saying, and finally you end up with this physical and mental pliancy as the actual antidote to laziness. So you have no qualms. You like it. It's easy to do it. You actually have a sense of mental and physical joy in relation to karma biting. And I was thinking the same with me. You could go to the closet, I can remind, there's that coat that I really like. I'll put it on again. And the natural joy arises in the mind and in the body of wearing it again. But I like this example. I quite like the examples when you can put it into a mundane context, an ordinary context, and go, I actually do that. And you go, well, here, the only thing that's changing is the object. So we've actually got it comes down to again and sort of saying, well, what's so great about karma biting? And to familiarize yourself with its good qualities again and again. And then you can have a conviction or a faith in those good qualities, then you aspire to have them. Now, the next question asked about how each of these qualities were beneficial. So each of these stages were beneficial. So we'll go through all of these, but we'll start off with pliancy. So I just put up three here. So it brings an immediate end to laziness. Secondly, it's a tremendous boon for cultivating the succeeding stages on the path to awakening. So in other words, it's a tremendous help to have physical and mental pliancy to engage in the practice of a special insight and then to keep on going. And this is an interesting one, so it's saying it is a joy not to be feared. So what used to happen, Fran, and it's this thing, so people, when they have this experience, it's like, this could generate like attachment. I must not get attached to this feeling, to this joy. And in fact, there's a lovely story of the Buddha when he was a child meditating under this tree. Yeah, he was watching a festival of some sort. And he felt this, he did the meditation, entered into the states of karma biting, went up to the different realms, and it was a state of joy. And then he sort of like forgot it for years and years and years. And then when he was later on going through the stage of being the ascetic, he remembered. He thought, I remember that time when I was a kid. I watched that and there was a sense of joy. Surely that joy is not a bad thing. And it's not. So, again, he engaged and he made his breakthrough. So again, I'll just read you a little bit. Now, this is from the book by, what's her name? The author, Andrea Zeller, I think it is. Maybe it's not Andrea. It's this book about the meditative states. So according to Lati Rinpoche, pliancy is the actual antidote to laziness. However, pliancy is the physical and mental serviceability that allows a meditator to remain focused on an object of observation without distraction at will for as long as he or she wishes. It's attained only with the achievement of karma biting. and therefore cannot help the beginning meditator directly. Dzogchen Geshe Gyalpo Lodro regards pliancy in this context as a benefit arising from the process of applying the first three antidotes of faith, aspiration, and perseverance. So this is what Wallace was getting at. You know, you start off with the conviction, you have the aspiration, the fruit, and just going around in that circle again and again, this is making the mind pliant and usable.
Eddie, this sounds a lot like when we normally talk about mastery, the great ease and joy that you have when you have complete mastery over a topic.
That's right, So applying the first three antidotes is said to be used as an antidote in the sense that one can reflect on the benefit of having pliancy. However, he regards the first three antidotes to laziness or spiritual sloth as more important for beginning meditators, you know, up through the third mental abiding. Lati Rinpoche, again, points out that pliancy is directly useful as an antidote to laziness for meditators, cultivating special insight, or the mental contemplations of individual knowledge of the character of each of those realms. Such meditators have already achieved calm abiding, and with it mental and physical pliancy. So for them, therefore, pliancy arises after exertion. So what it's sort of saying here is that the degree of pliancy is very different from when you begin to when you find the end. And you actually have it when you have calm abiding, you know, the actual state of calm abiding. You've got both types of pliancy, and that's how you know you've got it. But just as you can't have a result without causes, the three actual things of faith or conviction, aspiration and perseverance, and going over that again and again, is setting in place the conditions for actual pliancy. So the pliancy is developing in increments. Now, the next section was called joyous perseverance. So joyous perseverance is beneficial because your body and mind spontaneously begin to express enthusiasm for practice. And finally, the fatigue of laziness just stops. Aspiration is beneficial because it's a wholesome wish for attainment and realization. So this here also, you can see here, Fran, of how, because it's a wholesome wish, it's not attachment. And then and it leads to the previous one, enthusiastic perseverance. And the faith or conviction, it uniquely takes delight in freedom from the contaminants of mental afflictions.
Eddie, I've got a question. So just in that previous slide of the wholesome wish, so how do we go about turning our attachment, you know, and of perfectionism from that, like unpicking that attachment and turning it into something wholesome? So it's got to do with our motivation, doesn't it? How do we change that aspiration from it being like crippling perfectionism? To being a wholesome wish?
Well, you have to find the antidotes to the first problem. So one of the simplest ones I can think of is dependent arising. Like you can't be perfect without doing the work. And what do you mean by perfect? If you wish to be perfect, it means Buddhahood. So if you're not a Buddha, you're not perfect. No problem. I think I'm not a Buddha. And if I don't actually do any work, I'll never be one.
Right, so don't expect to be a Buddha immediately, first go.
And it's wholesome because, it's not... When you think of what you're trying to do here, it's like to free yourself of every type of mental affliction. Isn't that a good thing? So you you know, don't harm yourself and that you don't harm others. And then even more important, to actually help others. That's wholesome. So another way, you know, oftentimes coming from a Christian background or hearing, you know, the word faith so many times in our culture, oftentimes it's just called conviction. So being convinced that this is a very good, having calm abiding would be a very good thing to have. And as faith or conviction is the basis of yearning for virtue, it is regarded as the entrance to all the virtues. Okay, so now, next wish is, what are the good qualities of concentration, like outlined within this context? Now, there are a lot of them, but I'll just basically put up a few of them. So you will abide in happiness in this lifetime. So, like, you might ask, well, how? So can anybody quickly give me a quick answer of how one's happiness would certainly increase in this lifetime?
Body and mind are filled with bliss and delight.
Yep, that would be like an outcome of having calm abiding. But suppose we don't actually have calm abiding, but we actually have deepened states of concentration. What would be the, how could we abide in happiness if we had deeper states of concentration?
Less distractions, less on virtue.
That's right, less distraction, right?
Lesser mental afflictions, Eddie?
Lesser mental afflictions, that's right, Chris. Yeah, if we can just concentrate on virtuous states of mind, even without calm abiding, then the non-virtuous states of mind can't arise. And as you say, Stu, you know, if we just could move our mind to concentrate on what we chose to concentrate, that'd make it a lot easier for us. Since you have attained physical and mental pliancy through the power of concentration, you can turn your attention to any virtuous object of meditation you choose. And since you've quelled uncontrolled distraction towards the wrong sort of objects, you are not constantly involved in wrongdoing, and any virtue you do is very powerful. And fourth, based on calm abiding, you can achieve good qualities such as the super knowledges and the super normal powers. And finally, you develop the realization of insight that knows the real nature, whereby you can quickly cut the root of cyclic existence. So all of these are just taken from the Lam Rim, Lama Song Kapa's Lam Rim Chen Ma. And he says there on page 34, if you reflect on any of these good qualities, you will become aware of and meditate upon things that strengthen your inclination to cultivate concentration. When this inclination arises, you will be continually prompted from within to cultivate concentration, so it will be easy to attain it. And since you will cultivate it repeatedly, even after attaining it, you'll be unlikely to lose it. Now, so one of the few people, lay people that I know that has a real desire to achieve the state of concentration, well, there's two of them. One is Corrie, and the other one would be Glenn Svensson. So two Westerners that we know of really understand that, you know, that they need to develop stable and good states of concentration to actually bring about any deep and long-lasting spiritual change. So look, we're just up on 11, and there's a new section that's coming up called the objects of meditation. So this.
I know you're very keen. Very, very,
very, very, very keen this morning. Yes. Well,
there's so much material.
You don't have to do the whole thing today, Eddie. It's okay.
Well, I don't know. I suppose there's no time to lose. There's so much there and no time to do it all in, you know. We'll just have to give up sleeping.
That's Lama Zopa Rinpoche's advice. That's his life hack. Just sleep less.
Okay, we'll begin then. So welcome back, everybody. And so basically what we've gone through is a review, I think, of material that we've already covered. Is there anything anybody would like to ask about that material or add to it or in any way?
Well, we're all just dumbfounded, Eddie. Or too scared to ask.
So, in brief, we've sort of gone through the preconditions for engaging in the practice of calm abiding, and then we've looked at one of the first problems that arises called laziness or spiritual sloth, and the four opponents to that spiritual sloth being faith or conviction, aspiration, joyous perseverance, and finally, mental pliancy. And mental pliancy being the actual antidote, the others really helping and supporting that pliancy. So then we'll go back to our slides. And here our question is, he says that objects of meditation are presented in two parts. What are these and what kinds of object does each refer to? So here are these two here, the objects of meditation. There's a general presentation, and then there's going to be identifying objects of meditation for this context. And there are quite a few of them, as you will know when you've read that material. Nia Zala, from her book, Study and Meditation in the Tibetan Tradition, said this about objects of meditation. And I think this is really in here because some of you might be familiar with, like, for instance, the Zen tradition or the Nyingma tradition and the Dzogchen. Right? So there are terms you might come across there, like they call it objectless meditation. So those, when you read about it, it's like you have no, there is no object of meditation. But here, this is not the case. So the author says the presupposition underlying Gelug discussions of the topic of objects of observation is that the meditator has an object of meditation. Mere withdrawal of the mind from sense objects is not the cultivation of calm abiding. A warning against cultivating a meditative equipoise of non-discrimination occurs during discussion of the physical basis of calm abiding and of the concentrations and the formless absorptions. Moreover, about meditation on emptiness, some of the Buddhist teachers, especially in the Gelug tradition, emphasize that meditation on emptiness is not the same as withdrawing from conceptuality. So what's being said here is that, when you meditate, when you actually meditate on emptiness, when you're actually in that state, there is no conceptuality. The conceptuality is absent when you meditate, when you're actually on emptiness. But just to withdraw the mind from conceptuality does not produce emptiness. That's not emptiness. That's what they're getting at here. And this is a mistake. This is a mistake that they're suggesting that people could easily make, thinking that just because when you're in emptiness, it's a non-conceptual state, you can just withdraw the mind from conceptuality, and that would be emptiness. And they're saying no. Furthermore, again from the study in meditation, it says the object of observation of calm abiding is said to be internal. That is mental. Gelugpa scholars refute the position that a sense object, especially the object of an eye consciousness, can serve as object of observation for calm abiding. These scholars hold that calm abiding is achieved with the mental consciousness, not with a sense consciousness. To achieve calm abiding, it's necessary to withdraw the mind inside. And as Gedon Lodro explains, it is impossible to withdraw the mind inside unless the sense consciousnesses are stopped. Since the sense consciousnesses are by their very nature distracted to external objects. Gedon Lodro qualifies this position by noting that the only person who can remain in a state of deep meditative equipoise while sense consciousnesses operate is a Buddha. Is this okay for everyone? Is there anything anybody would like to query or ask about or anything?
It just seems very dramatic, Eddie, like to put it like that.
Yeah, well, it's because I think others have made these have different way of looking at things. And actually in this particular book by Zala, there are positions put forward that, now, for instance, I'll tell you, so, you know, I have a good friend of mine, and he is in the, his Lama is in the Shakya tradition, and he's been interested in developing calm abiding for years. So I asked him, what do you focus on? What's your object of focus? Because he was having difficulties for many years too. And it wasn't seeming to go anywhere. So I said, what do you focus on? And he said, a blue lotus. And I went, what? And he said, yeah, this blue lotus. So he said, yeah. And he said, actually, when I've been teaching the people who come to my place to learn, I've got the lotus that my teacher gave me, and I asked them to look at this, and this is what they had to concentrate on. And I said, that's never going to happen. You're never going to develop calm abiding like that. And he says, well, this is what my teacher told me. You know, this is the object and blah, blah, blah. And I went, okay, well, I'm not going to have an argument about this. If your teacher said this to you, well, that's what he said. You know, that's what you're doing. And so, like, why that object? And then, you know, so I read the history, not the history so much, but the lineage holder of the Shakya tradition was a great meditator called Vairupa. And he developed calm abiding depending on this image of a blue lotus. But it was a mental image. It wasn't a visual image. And my friend had been looking at the visual image. And then think, you know, so it's like a literal, he took the literal meaning of what his master had said to him. And perhaps his master hadn't explained it clearly enough that actually it's a mental image of the lotus. So it's the same with us, isn't it? You know, as often it's said, you know, as you'll see, there's many objects you can use to develop calm abiding, but they're all mental images. So sometimes it says, you know, like we use an image of the Buddha. So you start with that, like you have to see it, you have to look at it, but you're not like focusing with your eyes on it. You look at it and then you should turn away and go, okay, so I've got to draw it back up into my mind. What's it look like now? Can I imagine it? What am I imagining when I turn away and I imagine the Buddha? What do I actually see? you sort of look back at it, oh, it's like this, it's about this, you know, it's like this. I have to imagine it being heavy if my mind is very flighty. It's got to be at this level or that level. The robes are here, the hair's like that. And oftentimes you need to talk it into existence. But it's a mental image. It's not one like, it's not an external thing that you're staring at with your eyes. So yeah, Miffy, so it is dramatic. I think perhaps because there's been these simple mistakes that people make in terms of developing calm abiding. It's quite possible to develop states of concentration, sure, using your senses, but you can only go so far with it.
Because so many people also just focus like on a candle or a still lake, and it's like this rookie mistake of thinking of focusing outwards with our eyes. Right. And of course it's got to be a mental image, something internally. But I mean, no wonder we make that mistake, and all the popular culture is about focusing your eyes on an external thing to calm down. And of course it does calm us down a little bit because we're not thinking about all the other things, but what a waste of effort. Francesca?
Yeah, I was just thinking if you're looking at that external thing and just focusing completely on that, isn't that just a form of developing single-pointed concentration on that object alone? And then, you know, then you're not distracted by other thoughts. But if you're trying to do it as a mental thing, and which is really hard for me because I've got no way of stilling my mind yet, you know, so I do sort of try and look at the breathing or whatever is the, you know, the physical thing initially, but I still sort of can't quite achieve that mental, you know, transform it into a mental thing rather than an external thing. But I suppose you just keep going until you get better at it.
I take sort of sense of hope from an article I read some time ago where the people said just what you're saying, Fran. I just can't visualize. I can't see these things. And so the teacher says, do you ever worry about anything? And the guy goes, oh, yeah. That's a mental image. They're concentrating on mental images because that's what worry is. So I like to use it like, you know, and worry is about imagining. Things haven't happened yet, or they have, but what's going on here is not the external thing that happened, it's your internal objects, our imagination. So I like the term, can you imagine? And we all can.
And Eddie, I mean,
we all do it like mind on what you imagine.
If you've got a car, everyone knows what your own car looks like. It's not like you have trouble going, oh no, what does my car look like? It's just through familiarity, isn't it? You see your car every day, and then when you're looking for your car, you know what it looks like. And right now, I'm sure everyone knows what their own car looks like without going, oh my gosh, I got to imagine it.
Yeah, that's not really, or I've got to go outside and look for it. I've got to actually see it first before I know that's my car. There you go. No, I don't need to do that. I know what my car looks like. So we say, I know what my car looks like. That's your meditative object. That's your mental object. The thing is that some of these objects are objects that we're not used to. But as you'll see as we go through, there's these different kinds of objects. That we don't have to do all of them. We've just got to find the ones that are best for us at this particular time, and you can move through them. So I'll just come back and move along now. So like I said, so we've got different kinds of objects, and in the way it's presented again, we've got this general presentation and within the context of calm abiding or serenity. There's objects within that. So in the general presentation, we have the objects themselves and who should meditate on those objects. And finally, there's synonyms for the object. So this is where our class sort of finished off, or Kensa Rinpoche's commentary finished off on the synonyms for the object. So for the objects themselves, in terms of the general presentation, we've got universal objects. So here we have four types. So there is discursive images and non-discursive images. So we've got a couple of questions about them. Then there's called the limits of existence and the achievement of your purpose. So within the universal objects, there are four. Then in terms of purifying behavior or purifying conduct, there are five meditative objects. So you'll know them as being unpleasantness, loving kindness, dependent related events, distinctions among the constituents, and the respiration. And so there's more questions coming up about those. Then there are the meditative objects of expertise. And these were the aggregates, the elements, the sense spaces, the 12 links of dependent origination, and possibility and impossibility. And finally, for purifying mental afflictions, there were the tranquil and the gross aspects of the higher and lower planes, and the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. So there's a lot of material one could focus on to generate calm abiding. So what we're going to do now is have a look at each of these different general objects. So the first one had to do with these universal objects and the discursive images and the non-discursive images. And the question is, what's the difference between them? So we've got discursive images, and the object here is one for developing insight. And we're to stabilize it with analysis. Whereas the non-discursive, the object is calm abiding. And here we stabilize without analysis. Now, when we look at the at these other books that I've been looking at, where they go into quite detailed, there's sort of discussion about these. So this is from Alan Wallace from Balancing the Mind. He says, Lama Tsongkhapa explains that the first of the four kinds of pervasive object, being the universal object, is a mental image on which, for the purpose of developing calm abiding, the attention is focused without analysis. That's on the non-discursive side. Now, the second kind is a mental image on which, for the purpose of developing insight, the attention is focused and accompanied with conceptual analysis. Thus, this twofold classification is made in terms of the type of attention that's focused on the meditative object. So here's this, and then from the Lamrim Chenmo, it says the image is not the actual specifically characterized object upon which your mind is focused, but rather the appearance of that object's aspect to your mind. In other words, it's the imagined object, it's the mental object that you're getting at to develop insight or serenity upon. So I suppose, if you had to do a meditation on emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, you could do that meditation using calm abiding or insight or the combination of both of them. Your original object will be a mental construct, the idea, the correct idea. And you can just rest your mind on the correct idea without any analysis whatsoever, or you could take that object and start to analyze. That's what it's sort of getting at here. Is there anything unclear about what's going on here? Another example I could give you. So in terms of the discursive object, right? So the object there, so discursive will give, should give you the idea that, like, you're thinking. You are thinking about this object. You're trying to get insight into the object. So, for instance, suppose you're worried about something. Let's suppose your partner hasn't come home yet and they haven't rung you. So you are worried. You have a partner who hasn't rung you. That's your object of insight. So you're focused on that and you are thinking about, why haven't they rung me? And that's where your mind stays, but it's stabilized on that object with your concern. That's the only object you're focused on here. You don't, if you went off to, but oh my gosh, I've forgotten to turn the stove off, that's a different object. Right? The mind is stably just on this one object, and you are concerned and you are using your thinking processes. You're trying to get insight into the situation. Perhaps they haven't got their phone with them. Perhaps, you know, you think of all sorts of things, but it's just about that. You're trying to get insight into the situation. It's all mental.
Yes, but that mental thing can be prone to flights of fancy. If you worry a lot, they're already dead on the side of the road, and how are you going to manage? And, you know, because you're nowhere near
that moment of time. What you're trying to do is to get insight into the situation. That's what I'm trying to get at here, Fran. Not whether it's wrong or right or anything. It's just what your mind is doing. The other one is that your mind is on it, but there's no thinking. You don't have all that backwards and forwards stuff. And that would be the stabilizing, the calm abiding side. So one is there's lots of movement. It's on the one object. The other is on the object, but there's no lots of moving. You know, sometimes when you can get a sense of dread or fear, and there's no thought going on. Like if your partner hasn't come home, right, and you've stopped thinking, but there's that they're not here. There's something wrong. But you're not thinking about all the different things of what might be wrong or why they haven't run or anything like that. Your mind is just on the fact that they're late. They're not here. I haven't got a number. So this is, I'm trying to demonstrate here in ordinary, mundane ways of discursive and non-discursive. And you can take that same idea and move it towards Dharma objects, internal objects of the mind. Like, for instance, the object to be negated when you're meditating on emptiness. So you know, okay, what's the object to be negated when I meditate on emptiness? Anybody?
Inherently existent independent I.
Yeah, that's right. An inherently existent object of, you can use all those names, though. That's what it is. And you can go, okay, so like if something did inherently exist, how would it exist? So asking that question, you've got to identify the object, right? It requires some thinking. You can't just like be blank and sit there go, what's the object? So that's analysis. You're trying to get insight and produce this object. Oh, if I had an inherently existent eye, how would it appear to me? How would it exist? That's all analysis, right? Insight into the object that had inherent existence, if such an object existed. Now, once you've got it, it's like, okay, now stop thinking. I've identified it. That's it. No more thinking. That's it. I've just got to hold that idea in mind. Now you've gone to the non-discursive side. Because, I mean, we do this all the time. You know, we think about some things and then we just stop thinking about it in terms of the analysis, but it's still held in mind. But that's just what it's getting at here. Then there's the question about diversity. So I ask you what diversity referred to. So sometimes you get these questions, you receive the two terms, the diversity and the reality. That has been the two opposite things. So the diversity just means like everything, the things that conventionally exist, what does and what does not exist. When we talk about the reality, we're talking about the empty of the diversity, the empty nature of all the diversity. So here the diversity is referring to the five aggregates, the 18 constituents, the 12 sources, the four noble truths, and so forth. It's like, you look at that, it's like everything. And they're all conventional phenomena. So then we look at this diversity and says, well, like I said, so you could describe it in terms of the five aggregates, the 12 sources, the 18 constituents, the four noble truths, and so forth. And so now we have some questions about this diversity, how it's divided. So the first one was to fill in that chart of the 18 constituents. Yeah? So we had the six sense powers, the six objects that the sense powers engage in, and the six types of consciousness that arise and depends upon this engagement. And we'll see later on, if you ask, so what's the point of doing that? What are we trying to do here? Any ideas, anybody? Okay, well, we'll come to it later on. And like I said, so this is part of what they call the diversity. So we're looking at all, the many of all the things that make up the reality. The reality is that all these phenomena are empty. We're talking about what's the real nature of anything? You'll know they're talking about emptiness, the empty nature of whatever the diverse phenomena are. And then we have this question in the context, what is the achievement of purpose? So here, I first of all made a guess at this. I thought, well, what we're talking about here, because I thought, the context, what's the context here, anyone? What are we talking about here?
Objects of meditation.
Sorry, Sue, what's that again?
The objects of meditation and how we can overcome problems by focusing on certain objects of meditation.
And so different ways of answering this question. So my first answer, of course, was in this book, it's karma vaidic. That's the context of all of our study, isn't it? The idea is to attain like karma vaidic. Yet when I read up on this, the achievement of purpose, that wasn't in there. However, it is in there in the next teaching, the Kinsa Rinpoche lives. So I was going, okay, I found it. I said, I'm not wrong. It's just that it wasn't specifically said in the teaching we've got, right? So achievement of purpose is the result or the fruit. So oftentimes it's given us like liberation or enlightenment. That's the fruit, but it's like the big one. Yeah, but as I said, in this context, it's karma abiding. Now here we have this next question, the afflicted behavior. So this is, the objects for purifying your behavior. And the question is, what are the five objects listed and what afflicted behavior is each used to purify? So we had ugliness or the unpleasant, and that is to purify attachment. So the next one is, of course, called loving kindness. What's loving kindness to purify, anybody?
Hatred.
Hatred. Ill will and hatred. That's right. And the third one is dependent arising. So does anybody know what dependent arising is to purify?
Ignorance.
That's right, ignorance, in particular, the ignorance of grasping to a self. Self-grasping ignorance to purify the delusion of an attachment to self. And here was this one I about the constituents, right? So we had these, the 18 constituents before. So anybody, so here, the differentiation of the constituents to purify the pride of being attached to them. So the constituents like make up the body and mind of the person, isn't it? And we can often think that we are the body or the mind and to take pride in having a great body or a great mind. And finally, we have inhalation and exhalation is to purify ideation. So what's ideation, right? So the first thing I put down wasn't ideation, of course. It was, I thought, distraction. So I'll tell you a little about this term, ideation. And this is, again, from Alan Wallace, Balancing the Mind. Ideation is a specific type of conceptualization which has the general characteristic of apprehending its main object by way of an idea of it. While conceptualization is indispensable for such mental functions as memory and inference, in Buddhist literature, the term ideation normally carries a negative connotation, suggesting a compulsive, at times chaotic outflow of discursive thought. The prescribed remedy for compulsive ideation or discursiveness or distraction is to attend to the respiration. For example, by counting each inhalation and exhalation. Okay. And then we have this next expertise in what they call the five objects. And these five objects were the aggregates, the constituents, the sources, dependent arising, and what is and is not possible. Now, I'll say this then, okay. So what are we to know about, how are we to become experts in these aggregates? It's to know that apart from these, there is no person as an entity distinct from those aggregates. So, you know, so when we do analysis and we go through ourselves and ask, well, am I the body? We go, no. Am I feeling, discrimination, compositional or consciousness? Am I any of those things? We go, no, I'm not the same as them. Oh, so that I exist distinct from them. Yeah, no. Right? So we can, and that's what we need. We need to place our mind on it and know I don't exist as an entity distinct from the aggregate. But, you know, to concentrate on that knowledge that we are not the aggregates and we're not. This is expertise in the aggregates is knowing that apart from these aggregates, the self and what pertains to the self do not exist.
Eddie, Jeanette has a question.
Yep, Jeanette.
Eddie, this bit, I was just reading through these notes on page 45, this question about a self distinct from the aggregates. One of the nuns has said to Geshe-la, so there is a person that is other than the form aggregate in the, where does it say, in the formless realm.
Yep.
And then I don't understand whether he's refuted that or whether he said, yeah, that's true, because he says something about her mind is thinking, you know, she's thinking about
it.
Yeah,
that's right. Yep.
So is she wrong?
No.
No.
That's right.
So there is a there's a person distinct from the aggregates.
No, that's not what's being said there. Say that again. What was said?
Is there a person distinct from the aggregates in the formless realm?
The aggregate of form, she means.
No, but he said, is there a self that exists apart from these aggregates? It's not just one aggregate.
Yeah.
Is there a self that is other than the aggregates?
Yep, so she's saying, what she's in saying
the
from... Form,
she says, in the formless realm, there is.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to know if that's right or not, because I can't take it from
Because in this realm, because we've got... In the formless realm, they don't have the aggregate of form.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's no aggregate of form. So is there a person that's in the formless realm? Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just don't get it. I'm going to leave it. I just don't understand.
Yeah.
So is there...
But do you get the rest of the conversation that follows?
No.
Oh, okay. Right. Because that was really nice, the rest of it. And that's why I put this one up here. There's no entity. They are the same entity, but that doesn't mean to say they're the same thing.
Yeah, no, like the Gompa and the puts in
yeah,
the
Gompa. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Same
entity. That's right.
I still don't get with this formless realm. No, I don't get it. But I'll just leave it, Eddie, because I don't want to hold up the class. Yeah, yeah.
So there's different presentations. So what they would say actually is there's no gross form there. It's subtle form, very subtle form. There is a form there, but it's very subtle form. So for instance, what they're getting at here is like one of the forms is visible form. Right? So like I'm looking at the person called Jeanette, and my eyes are seeing your color and shape. That's visible form.
Yeah.
And if I could actually, I could actually touch you, that would be, there's another type of form name for that too. And all those things. Right? So that's the form, right? In the formless realm, that's not there. The color and shape is not there.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a person there? You say, yeah. They just don't have the form of the colour and shape.
How is that? I don't understand that.
Yeah, because it's the mental form.
Oh, mental form.
Yeah.
All right. Well, wait a minute.
Okay, so this is what expertise means, is to have this knowledge and be like, know why that is the case. That's you have expertise in this. In the constituents, it's knowing that these causal conditions arise from their own causes, from their own seeds, from their own potentials. In the sources, it's knowing the relationships between the six internal sources, the six external sources, a mind, and all that's having ceased, all their conditions. The 12 factors are impermanent, suffering, and devoid of self. And what is and is not possible, being certain in relation to the karmic actions we take. So does anybody know what this last one refers to?
Virtue leads to happiness.
That's
and
right.
Non-virtue leads to suffering.
Non-virtue leads to suffering. So to be like, to have that ingrained, that you're like, that means you have expertise in that. So it's never the case that non-virtue leads to happiness and virtue leads to unhappiness. It's always the case that virtue leads to happiness, non-virtue leads to suffering. So that's having expertise in karma, cause and effect.
So, Eddie, is this one really related to renunciation? Because if you are certain in that, then obviously you're... not going to be involved in short-term, you know, actions that have long-term bad consequences.
It could lead to, it would certainly, like, you've got two cases there. If one could be the causes of renunciation, the other could be the effect of renunciation. And it's just how you want to look at it. So these meditative objects of expertise, these five meditative objects of expertise, negate a personal identity that is not included among those phenomena. In other words, they're facilitating the birth of insight that realizes identitylessness. There is no person that is these things, and there's no person existing as an intrinsic identity separate from them. So the thing here is, like all of this material, you've got to come back to, when you place your mind on it with calm abiding, you've got to see, actually have insight into it. They're all leading to insight. One we've already gone through, but I don't know why they asked again, but it's, what are the objects of meditation for purifying the afflictions? So ugliness is to purify what affliction, anyone?
There's this internal beautiful thing that's not affected by anything else. It's not.
Purify a desirous attachment. What's love and kindness to purify, anyone? Fran?
Hatred and ill will.
Hatred and ill will, that's right. What's dependent arising to go against?
Ignorance.
Yeah, that's right. Ignorance of the self-grasping of an inherently existent person or phenomena. The distinctions amongst the constituents, what's that to purify?
Pride.
That's right. Thank you. Afflictive pride. And lastly, we have respiration, and that is to purify the affliction of?
Discursiveness. That's what I've got written in.
That's good. Discursiveness. That's right. Overactive thinking. Blah, blah, blah. That's excellent. Good on you. Now I've got these last couple of questions to do with meditating on the sticks and signs. So meditating on pebbles and sticks, right? It says, why is it not so beneficial to develop concentration on an object like a pebble or a twig? Any answers, any from anyone?
Because it's not a virtuous activity. And yeah, it's
excellent.
Not
going to... So that's it, no virtuous focus.
And it's not right. Going to help you develop wisdom.
That's it, great. No development of insight either. So all those other objects, Lama Tsongkhapa is saying, look, better place, develop karma body on all those other objects we just talked about rather than pebbles and sticks. The aggregates, the constituents, and so forth. All those different things. Right? Because they produce something else that's very useful. Yeah. So Wallace from Balancing the Mind again, he says, as Tsongkhapa points out later, karma abiding cannot be accomplished simply by focusing the attention on a visual object. Rather, the actual object of concentration must be a direct object of mental, not sensory consciousnesses. The reason that concentration is not accomplished in sensory consciousness, but in mental consciousness, is that the potency of attentional stability and clarity is maximized only when the attention is drawn inwards, away from physical sense objects. Nevertheless, the cultivation of quiescence, or karma abiding, may begin with focusing the attention on a physical object, then develop further by attending to a mental image of that object. And finally, we come to this question, what does the term apprehension of signs mean? Anybody know?
Grasping at true existence.
Yeah, grasping at true existence is the most common understanding of the apprehension of signs. Signs, is putting it, signs of true existence, signs of inherent existence. So that's the first one. What else could apprehension of signs refer to? In brief, it's the object of focus. The internal mental object that you're focused upon. That's the sign. Focal point for the mind.
Eddie, does that have the connotation then that when we, even when we're focusing on that object, we still know that it's empty of inherent existence?
No, it doesn't have that connotation. No.
No, it's just far more straightforward.
Yeah, that's right. It's just straightforward. Okay. The object can appear truly existent. It doesn't often mean we're always grasping it to be truly existent. And finally, the question is the object, is the focus upon an object of meditation an apprehension of signs? Then you have to say, well, not necessarily. So if you have, this is great. So if you have a consciousness, then you are conscious of something. So you must accept that there is an object of consciousness in terms of which the consciousness is posited. There's a really lovely bit there at the end there where Kintsa Rinpoche does that analysis. Like if he goes, if there is no consciousness whatsoever, can there be an object of consciousness? Come on, folks, I'm asking a question.
No.
No. That's just no. If you don't have a consciousness, how can you have an object of consciousness? Now, suppose you have an object of consciousness. Do you have a consciousness?
Yes.
Yes.
And there's a consciousness that knows that object, doesn't it? If there is an object of consciousness, then precisely that is the object of meditation of that mind. So there's the reference point. There's the object. It's what that mind is directed toward. Because object, object of meditation, object of consciousness have the same meaning. Now think about if you were to meditate on emptiness. And these guys are saying, no, there is no object. If there is no object, how can you know emptiness?
You're focused on the fact that nothing inherently exists?
How do you know it's a fact?
Through analysis.
Yeah, right. So through the analysis, you actually have you see that the objects that you started with are empty. That's your object. The object appears. Inherent existence is not there, is it? That's what you're looking for. Does the object have the inherent existence it seems to have? No. That's right, no. That is its emptiness. There's an object. Your mind actually sees, oh my gosh, the object I thought had inherent existence does not have inherent existence. It is empty of inherent existence. And you rest your mind on the lack of inherent existence, the emptiness. So if there's no object, you can't know emptiness. There's no inherently existent object. That's the emptiness of the object. Now, they're saying, well, if that's the case, and you can actually meditate on emptiness, emptiness has to appear to you as inherently existent. Because this is what they're saying, like, if you're focused upon an object of meditation, does it have inherent existence? And the answer would be, not necessarily. Anyway, think about it. Think about it, have a little look at that last bit. Because this is what Lama Tsongkhapa is really interested in doing. What they're pointing out is that, and Geshe said, yeah, so when people come and talk to you about Dzogchen, what are you meditating on? And they say, well, yeah, like, what are you meditating on? What are you becoming familiar with? What are you going to say? Nothing. You know, we don't have an object to meditate on. There is no object to meditate on. If there's no object to meditate on, then you actually, in other words, you're saying, so you have no consciousness. And you go, I'm aware. So, well, if you have consciousness, what's the object of consciousness? And so at the end, Gessler was saying, perhaps what they should say, and maybe it hasn't been explained to them very well, that's the clarity of mind. That's their object. But that's not emptiness. It's just the clarity of mind. And yeah, that is the conventional nature of the mind. So we need to find that. We need to actually acknowledge, wow, the mind is like clear. Well, while it's clear, it's knowing it's clear, right? You know, you see it. But that's not the emptiness. Then we have to go, okay, now we have to examine that. Anyway, that's the end of our class. I was like, to be honest, I don't think we're going to get through this. But we did. it took quite a massive putting together, this one. Anyway, think about it, folks. We went through like 25 questions. We basically got their answers. But next week, we're starting a new week 6. But here's the material to read through for pages from 42 to 48, volume 3, Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chenma. In terms of Geshe Thachi's hearings, commentary, we'll be up onto teaching 21 in module 3. And you know, it's like week 6, page 1 to 13. Here's the revision questions, called day 21. So we've come to the end of our class. I'm just going to say thanks for coming along with me on this joyride. We're learning something each week, which I think is fantastic, each fortnight. So let's dedicate our joy in our classes and our understanding and our willingness to try and our best to put it into work each day. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And may the supreme dual bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow, and may that born have no decline but to increase forevermore, such that as long as space abides and as long as sentient beings abide, we too will abide to dispel the suffering of all sentient beings. Okay, everyone. Again, thank you very, very much for coming along with me on our Sundays, and we'll see you in a fortnight.